At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Budget day is like tax day. It's never fun. No matter what, it's big numbers. So said the president earlier today as he released his budget proposal for the coming fiscal year. Hard to disagree. A few trillion here, a few trillion there, and pretty soon you're talking real money. And real politics. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. It is the first day of February. With a nod to our friends at Sesame Street, today's top story is brought to you by the number 3.8, because it made a twin appearance today. In the first instance, it's accompanied by the word trillion, as in the $3.8 trillion federal budget proposed by the White House today. And you'll find the second mention in that same document, where the budget assumes the economy will grow 3.8% next year. Of course, numbers like that do not come without controversy. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports on the highlights of Budget Day in Washington.
The budget forecasts a record $1.5 trillion deficit this year, over 10% of the entire economy. President Obama is still promising to cut that percentage in half by the end of his first term and get it down to 3% of the economy by 2015, but not right away.
We won't be able to bring down this deficit overnight, given that the recovery is still taking hold and families across the country still need help.
The proposed budget takes a small whack at deficits by capping spending on everything except national security, Social Security, and Medicare. Tax cuts for the wealthy will be allowed to expire. Josh Gordon at the Concord Coalition, which advocates for lower deficits, says Obama is doing the right thing by not cutting too much now. But
the real key is setting up the country for the even more difficult choices in austerity that we'll need in the longer term.
To bring the deficit under control, the budget depends on economic growth of 3.8% next year and above 4% for the following 3 years. But that depends on consumer spending. Professor Steve Hanke at Johns Hopkins University says the rate of government spending has scared consumers into shutting their wallets instead.
The stimulus program is a drag program. People are very worried about government expenditures and whether they're going to pay for them today or in a few years when they ultimately have to pay down the debt.
He says deficit reduction should begin right away. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Here's one winner in the White House budget, schools. The proposal sets aside about $50 billion for education, but the White House plans to make schools work for that money. And that very well could mean big changes for the No Child Left Behind program. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more from Washington.
No Child Left Behind is being left behind. The Obama administration wants to ditch much of former President Bush's signature education policy. It judged schools on how students did on national tests, but it didn't reduce funding for schools that didn't do well. The Obama plan is more like boost your grades or you don't get your allowance.
School districts will not be able to count on federal money year after year. They're going to have to prove that they've increased test scores in order to get that money.
Jack Jennings is president of the Center on Education Policy. He says right now, federal education money is doled out based on the number of students in a school district. The Obama administration wants some of that money to be awarded based on whether a school's graduating seniors are ready for jobs or college. Education Secretary Arne Duncan lays it out this way.
My real desire is simply to have a high bar for the country, a common definition of success.
That definition is being hammered out by governors and top education officials from more than 40 states. Some of the proposed standards might not be welcomed by everyone. Teachers' unions would be against any provision tying their evaluations to test scores. Jeff Smink is vice president of policy at the National Summer Learning Association.
A lot of groups may try and fight this if it does threaten funding, if it threatens some of the status quo that's going on in education right now.
Congress has to sign off on the administration's education proposals. Lawmakers are in the habit of snagging grants for their districts, regardless of test scores. The Obama administration wants to do away with that, too. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, investors put January behind them for a fresh and upbeat start to the new month. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Today, Toyota announced a fix for the faulty accelerator mechanism that forced it to recall millions of vehicles in the last couple of weeks. The logistics of repairing all those gas pedals are mind-numbing. But beyond questions of how it's all going to happen are concerns about why it happened and why it took so long to get a fix in place. Marketplace's Elisa Roth covers the auto industry, and she joins us from our bureau in New York. Hi, Elisa.
Hello.
So Toyota says it's sending out parts to dealers this week, but we've got 2.3 million vehicles that need this repair. How on earth is this going to work?
Well, the fix supposedly only takes about a half an hour to do. I talked to John McElhaney today. He's a Toyota dealer in Iowa, and he's also the chairman of the National Automobile Dealers Association. He says he's going to have six mechanics doing nothing but this fix.
We'll probably start an hour earlier in the morning or hour late in the afternoon. We already are open Saturdays, and it's a fairly simple fix, so I think we can do several dozen a day.
Now, he still doesn't know exactly how many vehicles his dealership is going to be responsible for, but he's guessing that at this rate it'll take him a couple of weeks to get through them all.
Wow. It seems like there is still an enormous amount of confusion over this recall, and Toyota is certainly not getting very high marks for its handling of all of this, are they?
Well, I'm not defending Toyota here, and I think it's probably way too soon to say with any authority when Toyota knew what was going on or whether it should have responded sooner. One of the problems the company's up against is how do you say when something is really a problem? I mean, if Toyota gets three complaints of unintended acceleration over a couple of years, how is the company supposed to know if the pedal really stuck or if the driver messed up somehow or what's really going on?
Well, of course, there are all kinds of questions now about the Toyota brand, what this recall is going to mean for a company that, by and large, managed to avoid spectacle for decades.
You know, there's been a lot of criticism even before this latest mess that Toyota had been putting quantity over quality. So basically focusing so much on the race to be the world's top automaker that it stopped paying attention to those details that made it Toyota. At the same time, though, Toyota does have this really rock-solid reputation for quality. And one person I talked to said he thought that if Toyota handles this incident well, it could actually be relegated to the history books within a year.
I wonder what we hear, if anything, about plans that the company does have to really retrieve this image of reliability. I mean, if this lasts longer than they thought it would, what can they do?
I think they started by getting Toyota really out there as much as they could. I don't know if you saw the Today Show this morning or CNBC. The head of Toyota USA was all over the news this morning. And the PR people I talked to today said, you know, that was a really good start. One of the people I talked to is a man named David Boulay. He's been doing public relations for auto companies for years. And he said he'd actually like to see that expanded a bit.
I would hope that there would also be other experts, people from automotive magazines and consumer groups that could put all of this in perspective.
And I talked to somebody else who said some visuals would actually be really useful, things like a YouTube video showing a mechanic actually doing the fix or some really clear diagrams of what's going to happen to your car.
You know, Elisa, for consumers, I wonder what this potentially means for resale value for all of Toyota's brands. Is there any talk about that?
There's actually been some talk. One of the big auction houses that deal with auto resales said that they were suspending sales of the recall Toyotas. So this could be a real issue for drivers. I think it'll depend in part on how well this fix actually works.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth talking with us from our New York bureau. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Walking around the neighborhood for exercise is more and more an exercise in, wow, where'd that store go? Empty storefronts litter main drags and alleyways of cities across the country. In fact, according to figures from real estate consultants Cushman and Wakefield, some 10% of retail space is now empty. But new businesses are coming along to fill those gaps. From the entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Mitchell Hartman has this report.
I'm standing on Sandy Boulevard, a busy four-lane road that runs through the heart of a bustling Portland neighborhood just a mile or so from downtown.
This would be classified as a storefront commercial on a major thoroughfare, probably post-war.
That's Mike Williams. He teaches real estate finance and works in the state's economic development department. He's helping me map this post-recession landscape. The boulevard's lined with shops and restaurants, some new, some old, some empty. There's a sprawling vintage clothing store that moved from a small space across the street into a defunct car dealership. A shop selling vintage furniture took its place.
There's sort of a supply and demand effect when it comes to vintage.
Williams says secondhand is hot all over the country as some people unload what they don't need and others buy used to live cheaper. We make our way down the boulevard, past a cell phone store, a Thai restaurant, to another orphaned car dealership. This one got the axe in the Chrysler bankruptcy. Now, some of the former showroom is an outlet for discount mattresses. Another section has been converted to cubicle space.
It's for short-term lease, something that would fit kind of a more entrepreneurial economy, people that may need a temporary place to stage themselves.
The thing about retail is that the space is always being recycled and adapted.
Chris Sherland analyzes commercial real estate at Cushman & Wakefield.
Properties have to adapt over time to reflect the changes in the marketplace.
Those changes now amount to a tectonic shift. In urban neighborhoods, the recession knocked out small retailers and repair shops that held on for decades. In their place, salons, bars, and restaurants that generate more traffic and revenue. In suburbs, community colleges and trade schools are moving into half-empty shopping centers. And wherever you look, services catering to aging baby boomers are moving in, says Richard Green of the USC Lusk Center for Real Estate.
So whereas there might have been a Spencer Gift before, there's now a doc in a box who can do urgent care for people at a fairly small price in a very convenient way.
Cheap, convenient, it's a pretty good formula for any kind of retailer to expand in a recession.
Could I get the one taco with the small salad, and could I do it for the shrimp one, the camarones?
My name is Brian Steelman, and I own Porque No Taqueria, some lowbrow Mexican street food.
Steelman opened his second taqueria in Portland's trendy Hawthorne District a year ago. It's been packed ever since. He took over a funky old building with hardwood floors and exposed beams that for 40 years was a family-owned upholstery shop.
Someone wouldn't be able to buy this building back and open up an upholstery shop and make the numbers work, partially because of the way that people are shopping at IKEA and just rebuying something when they need it, but also the way that the economy is changing.
Steelman says the speed and severity of the recession has accelerated the retail transformation, with new vacancies, lower rents, and contractors hungry for work.
It was an excellent time to get good quality construction crew on to do the work, and I do think that it was a good time to open up another place where people can come in and get a large sum of food for $6.50.
Back where we started on Sandy Boulevard, a few miles from that new taqueria, is another place you can do quite well with just $6.50 in your pocket.
And then behind us is Katie O'Brien's, which must be an ancient Irish pub.
It has good visibility, especially the coming home visibility. You have some retailers are on the way to work, some retailers are on the way home, and I guess you would go to a pub on the way home.
A reminder that some rules of the retail game will probably never change. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
And Mitchell shot a video of the shifting commercial landscape of his own neighborhood in Portland, Oregon. You can see it at our website, marketplace.org. And you'll also find instructions for shooting and posting your own retail drive-through video from your neighborhood. Coming up, why one state is betting on casinos to help balance its budget.
I don't think any legislator wants to raise taxes. And to the extent that we can find other ways of enhancing our revenue, we need to do that.
But first, let's do the numbers. Signs the recovery could be picking up steam helped lift stocks today. The Dow rose 118 points, more than 1%, to close at 10,185. The Nasdaq added 23 points, one and a tenth percent, to finish at 2,171. And the S&P 500 tacked on 15 points, nearly 1.5%, to end at 1,089. Reports the manufacturing sector grew at its fastest pace in 5 years helped fuel the enthusiasm. Shares in U.S. Steel forged ahead 6.5%. AK Steel picked up 6 1/3. And following on a couple of stories we mentioned earlier, Toyota shares rose nearly 4% after announcing that fix for the gas pedals. And Amazon.com dropped more than 5% after losing its fight with Macmillan Publishing. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.65%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. The trading day, we're talking business and the economy on our blog, The Scratchpad. Check in with online host Scott Jagow and join the discussion at marketplace.org.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. Congressional committees gather to examine President Obama's budget. The National Association of Independent Colleges and Universities continues its annual meeting in Washington. And a workshop takes place at the National Press Club for news outlets covering Haiti. It aims to support journalists with the stress and trauma of reporting from disaster areas. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Shares of Amazon.com shrank from their lofty heights today, and for this they can blame, in part, a certain new technology wunderkind you may have heard about last week. Prior to the introduction of the Apple iPad, Amazon had a near lock on setting prices for so-called e-books. But Apple's full-fledged entry into the market and the deals it struck with publishers have forced Amazon to rekindle its own relationship with those same publishers. Marketplace's Sarah Gardner has the latest.
Amazon had been selling e-books for $9.99 to fuel sales of Kindle, its e-book reader. That infuriated publishers, who said the price undervalued their products. Colin Sebastian at Lazard Capital Markets says the big publishing company, Macmillan, threw down the gauntlet.
And what we saw is Macmillan take an aggressive stand against Amazon and essentially say, if you don't price books higher than what you're doing right now, then we are going to give you access to those books later than other retailers, later than other distributors.
Amazon said Sunday it would capitulate to Macmillan, even though it believes $13 to $15 an ebook is too high. That's not only because Macmillan publishes lots of titles, Amazon also has new competition. Apple's new iPad also e-reads books, and Apple made it clear it's willing to sell e-books at higher prices than Amazon. Publishing consultant Mike Schatzkin says Amazon has reached the limits of its ability to bully publishers.
Now, that doesn't mean that they can't push publishers around at all anymore. But what it means is that their ability to say, we'll buy the books, we'll price them how we want, you don't like it, that's too bad, that's not going to work.
Ironically, the new e-book competition from Apple and eventually Google, which plans to open an online bookstore, is leading to higher prices, not lower, at least for the time being. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Today in China, the official state media outlet trained its sights on the Obama administration's announcement of a multi-billion-dollar arms sale to Taiwan. The China Daily said the move inevitably cast a long shadow on Sino-U.S. relations. The latest back and forth over those relations comes on the heels of angry words over internet censorship and Google's threat to pull out of the Middle Kingdom. Commentator Todd Buchholz says China faces a stark choice when it comes to internet freedom.
Mom and Dad used to say, finish everything on your plate. The kids in China are starving. Now those kids are eating our lunch. Why? China doesn't brim with oil or gold or any of the other precious commodities traded in the Chicago pits. But China has technological power. The secret to China's success came when Deng Xiaoping unleashed the economy back in 1979. Overnight, he went straight from praising Chairman Mao to inviting Mickey Mouse to set up camp. In his famous pronouncement on economics, Deng said, white cat, black cat, makes no difference, as long as it catches mice. But now China's cat and mouse game is getting dangerous. China is artificially holding down its currency, holding back imports, and now holding up the internet by calmly accepting the Chinese cyber hacking of Google. Hacking is a growth industry. According to Reuters, for $150, Chinese computer whizzes download all the tools and even the tutorial sessions needed to create havoc. China, which will harass a Falun Gong member who does yoga on the banks of the waterfront in Shanghai, can't be bothered to go after destructive hackers. By stifling Google and either permitting or encouraging attacks on the internet, China is setting itself up for a choice. Communist leaders in Beijing will have to choose whether they support free trade and a free flow of information, or whether they want to retreat to a simpler, less prosperous life. Beijing will have to choose between China.com or China.communism. China has certainly generated great growth in assembly line manufacturing, but guess what? There aren't enough of those jobs to keep a billion people employed. China will have to move into services, too. And that requires honest ideas, not piracy and spying. It's time for Beijing to stop rooting for the hackers and pull out their plugs.
Economist Todd Buchholz was an advisor to the first President Bush. His latest book is called New Ideas from Dead CEOs. Your thoughts? Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. It is a truism that during recessions, lottery sales spike. The lure of unspeakable riches from a $1 scratch ticket is only magnified by tough times. And the same can be said, apparently, of strapped governments. States around the country are turning to casinos to close huge budget holes. But Kansas has gone a step beyond allowing private companies to set up one-armed bandits. You might be shocked. Shocked to learn that the state is the owner-operator of those bandits. From station KCUR, Sylvia Maria Gross reports on the plan's odds for success.
Thanks to the TV show Gunsmoke, Dodge City, Kansas is best known for gunslinging, poker-playing cowboys.
I've got left $30.
But after the 1800s, gambling houses were banned in Dodge City. Until now.
Come on, baby.
Pam.
Oh,
bam.
Today, Dodge City's cowboys are mostly steel cutouts. But thanks to state legislators, the gambling houses are coming back. Kansas is the first state to run its own casino. It opened the new Boot Hill Casino and Resort on the outskirts of the city a little over a month ago. Jessie McNeese works at the casino. She says it's been packed since the day it opened.
It's hard to get through. I mean, there's a big crowd in here today.
The place has a Wild West theme, complete with swinging saloon doors and antique six-shooters.
Go ahead.
Jesse Urtiaga wears a big cowboy hat and chomps on a cigar as he works the slots.
I'm from Amarillo, Texas.
Did you drive up just to come to the casino?
Yes, I sure did.
Check it out.
So I better win.
If Urtiaga doesn't win, Kansas will, now that casino gambling is allowed outside reservations and now that the state owns the house. Kansas is hardly a stranger to gambling. It has several racetracks, four Indian casinos, and has run a lottery for 24 years. But despite its colorful frontier past, it's still a conservative place. Legislators blocked the law allowing casinos for 14 years before it passed in 2007. State Senator John Brattle says it was all about padding the state budget.
Every little bit helps. I don't think any legislator wants to raise taxes. And to the extent that we can find other ways of enhancing our revenue, we need to do that.
Other states that have allowed casinos benefit by taxing the casino operators. But Kansas couldn't do that. Its constitution says private companies aren't allowed to own lotteries or gaming operations. Changing the constitution would have taken years and a voter referendum. Rather than roll the dice, the government decided to set up shop itself. Ed Van Petten is director of the Kansas Lottery. He says because state money is involved, the lottery is keeping the operation as transparent as possible.
The financial issues and the operational issues are much more public than in a normal casino situation in other states.
It's a little bizarre.
Bill Thompson researches casinos and public policy at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. He says this is a strange setup. The private companies own the buildings, but the state says it owns the slot machines and even the cards and the dice.
The private operators pay property taxes to the state, and yet the state maintains that the state owns the casino. It's a fiction.
Fiction or not, Kansas will collect 22% of the casino revenue, and the local governments receive an additional 5%. That's about what other states get, a few tax at an even higher rate. Thompson says the state budget might benefit, but few casinos lead to real economic development.
It's local residents, and the money they're gambling in the casino is money they otherwise would spend at the store, and that doesn't help an economy at all.
The economy isn't helping Kansas. The state's original plan was to build four casinos. The Boot Hill Casino opened on schedule, but the state hasn't even broken ground on the other three. In Dodge City, Kansas, I'm Sylvia Maria Gross for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, penny pinching is back in vogue as the recession wears on, and so is penny bashing. Anti-penny voices have grown ever louder as the cost to make one far exceeds its actual value. And today's budget proposal from the White House contains its 2 cents worth. It suggests that the Treasury Department explore using less expensive metals for all coins, not just the penny. For example, the 5-cent nickel costs about 9 cents to make. Any viable solution could truly signal change for change's sake. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 118 points, more than 1%. The Nasdaq gained 23 points, 1 1/10%. And the S&P 500 picked up 15 points, nearly 1.5%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Eng. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, move over, cars. 2010 is the year for bike sharing.
People ask me all the time, is it like Zipcar on bikes? I always say, no, it's Zipcar on steroids.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.